Welcome to the Exodus Cry podcast, where we have honest conversations around exploitation, trafficking, sexual culture, and justice.
Joining us today, we have Jay Stringer, licensed mental health expert and author of Unwanted: How Our Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Jay, thank you so much for coming and joining us on the Exodus Cry podcast. We're very inspired by your work, and it's unique to this space, the depth of your research into the issue of men's, what would you just call it? I call it men's sexual health or struggle with their sexuality.
Yes.
And so really looking forward to just kind of exploring that topic with you. For us, you know, this past couple years, there's been a big emphasis on the subject of men's sexual health because of a film that we did called Buying Her, which explores the male demand for prostitution. And so staring at that brokenness and looking at, you know, what's underneath that, and then trying to find solutions for men to become healthy in the realm of their sexuality, so they're not contributing to this larger crisis of human trafficking. And so I just want to start with you just by asking, what interested you in this subject matter in the first place?
Oh, first off, thank you for having me, not just on your show, but in your studio in California. So good to be here. So in terms of what got me interested in this, I grew up in a religious home. My dad was a pastor. And so, you know, we did not receive almost any education on, you know, what it meant to be sexually healthy. It was kind of a lot of times when I think about it, I think about it in terms of people saying, you know, imagine going to culinary school and they don't teach you anything about how to cook, but they do teach you about salmonella and then expect some type of masterpiece from you. And that was kind of just a lot of what it was like growing up. Particularly in Christian faith-based cultures, was there was like a very clear sense of don't do this, but almost no language to be able to invite people to understand their motivations, why they were aroused by certain things, and how they could actually become healthy. And I think anytime you don't have language to be able to talk about what is going on, and just a lot of pathology and shame-based culture, a lot of the things that you don't understand are going to go underground. And so, you know, as I got into my own story, some of my own struggles with porn, and then clinically, I was working with a lot of men and women who were participating in extramarital affairs and a lot of men who were buying sex. And I just started seeing the sense of, you know, the current conversation that tells people, you know, don't do this, try and bounce your eyes, get into some accountability if you're struggling, just was not helping. And so I remember this quote from Desmond Tutu talking about apartheid, where he said, there comes a point where we need to stop just taking people out of the river. We need to be able to go upstream to find out why people are falling in. And when I heard that, I knew that that was going to be something of my life's work, is to go upstream to figure out why is there so much just sexual exploitation, sexual brokenness in our world. And so that's what the work that I'm really passionate about is, to go upstream to find out what's driving men to use and degrade women and beauty for their own sense of gain.
Yeah, we're right there with you. As I mentioned, this film that we were working on for actually 10 years and then have been doing screenings this past year, Buying Her, addresses this issue of male demand. So we follow the journey of these men from childhood exposure to pornography all the way into their adult life, acting out, buying women and children in sex and acting out in other deviant ways to really try to understand their whole journey. It's a very, in a way, dark and sobering thing to look at, but also something that's part of our humanity at this, you know, era in time, this point in history. There are a lot of men on the planet right now who are acting out in very, broken and predatory ways. And so our interest, you know, as an anti-trafficking organization is obviously to end trafficking. So our conviction is that if we can end the demand for trafficking, that we would see an end to this larger issue. So we just understand human trafficking to be a supply and demand issue. So we've been doing these screenings, and something that we say at these screenings is we're here to invite men. We're not here to indict men, but it is an invitation. The film is an invitation for men to come into the conversation, to come into the light, to begin to consider their own sexuality. There's a term that I've just been thinking around, this idea of men's sexual health. And so, yeah, just, you know, acknowledging kind of your starting point for entering into this work. And then for us looking at this really being sort of like the tip of the arrow thing to solve if we want to end human trafficking. I'm super interested to learn more from you about getting underneath that behavior. So there are men who, you know, are acting out by satisfying or attempting to satisfy or gratify their sexuality by watching porn. And then it just, you know, by participating in buying women and children in the sex industry, as you mentioned, there's extramarital affairs that are happening. And then there's all kinds of other more deviant, predatory layers to that. And so getting underneath that, what do you feel is the core brokenness or thing that needs to be healed in men to begin to see a change in how we're showing up in the world related to our sexuality?
Mm-hmm. So the first place that my mind goes is the topic of trauma. So trauma comes from the Greek word meaning wound. And so whereas kind of a scar might reveal an external wound, a lot of our emotional pain is kind of an internal scarring. And so one of the leading trauma therapists in the world has recently said that he does not believe that trauma is just something difficult that happened to us, but far more, trauma is what happens inside of us in the absence of an empathetic witness. So it's not just something that's difficult, but it's any experience that we go through that did not have an empathetic witness of someone actually seeing some of the pain and heartache that we will inevitably go through in life. And so the consequences of trauma are typically threefold. The first is that there's going to be some level of unaddressed pain. The second would be the need to numb that pain. And then the third is this inevitable sense of isolation. So a lot of men, especially as kids, did not have an empathetic witness to a lot of what they are going through. So I think of, you know, middle school is often like a prototype of hell. I know my nickname was Donut in middle school. Just a lot of shaming, a lot of humiliation that I had been through in school. And I don't think that I'm unique in that way. So when men have all of this unaddressed pain, the need to numb that pain is going to be able to take over. And so that could be early on in adolescence, that could be substances, that could be porn, something to be able to provide something of a reprieve from that, you know, very deeply painful experience. But then the more that you begin to numb out to a particular substance or behavior, that's inevitably going to create that sense of isolation from the shame of what you were just involved in. And the longer that we stay in a place of shame, the more aggressive our behavior is going to become. And so I think that is, you know, Father Richard Rohr says the pain that we do not transform, we transmit. Always someone else has to suffer because I don't know how to. And so I think that's so crucial for us as men to get, is if we have stories of unaddressed humiliation, places of powerlessness that have affected our life, we are going to transmit that pain onto others. And that, I mean, I think is just the convergence of trauma stories, where you have men who have unaddressed trauma creating a demand that creates trauma in primarily, I mean, women, but also in other men that are trafficked and exploited. And to me, that's just the madness of the moment that we're in is, unaddressed trauma compounds more trauma onto others. So I think that has to be the place to invite men into is if you have unaddressed stories of humiliation or powerlessness, the appeal to something like porn is not just because it's a fantasy and it's pleasurable, but far more. Porn is an issue of power. So if I come from a place of a lack of power in my life, that sets up the demand to kind of convert that trauma into a place of triumph and mastery, which is where the demand for porn really begins to get accentuated because I don't want to feel powerless and porn makes me feel deeply powerful. But if you're only trying to combat the issues of porn by telling men, don't do this, it's wrong, it's harmful to others, it's just not going to be effective until they really begin to address some of the trauma and heartache of their life.
So part of what I hear you saying is like that men, many men, not all men, but many men have experienced trauma in their life, particularly oftentimes in childhood. And then if I'm hearing you correctly, in a way, we'll sort of like reach for the thing that's closest to them to begin to numb that pain. And in our current world, oftentimes that is pornography. So that being the, am I hearing you?
Yes, right in that? Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. That being the equation, what do you think is needed in order to redirect particularly young men towards more healthy outlets? What do you think is needed to avoid looking for something as, you know, that's ultimately going to be as destructive as porn? Mm-hmm. As it's to me, like the way that I understand it is like you have, there's some, let's just say like a sickness in you, you know, just using that analogy for a moment, and your body needs vitamin C and it needs all these other things. But instead, you're feeding it all the things that got you sick in the first place. You're feeding mm-hmm. it sugar and, you know, whatever, like that analogy. And I kind of think that way about like porn, like there's some inherent brokenness here as a result of trauma. And you are in need of something to medicate, to heal that wound. And rather than having some kind of healthy outlet or medicinal access to some kind of something that would be more medicinal to our soul, to our spirit, to our psyche, are grabbing for something that's only going to further the pain, the shame, the wounding. How do we redirect men mm-hmm. Towards something healthy?
Yeah, such a good question. I think part of what we have to acknowledge is that a lot of times as men, we eroticize our pain. And so instead of kind of grappling with our pain, grieving it, becoming angry at the people that we really do need to become angry with, we begin to use porn and exploitation in order to find some level of power over someone else. And so I think that is what we have to go back to is if, say, a bully or an aggressive father or mother had a type of power over us, that's going to lead us to that place of, again, humiliation and powerlessness. And so a lot of what is required is to go back to some of those stories and allow our bodies to feel and to grieve some of just the heartache that we went through at that time. So I think of, you know, just that, you know, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. A lot of men tried to hide behind this notion that like porn is just about a place of comfort for me. But what they don't ever seem to really want to go back to are the stories that set them up to try and outsource their comfort to someone else or to something else. And so I think that's really central to men's work is to say, will you have integrity with your own pain? Not outsource the solution to someone else or something else, but will you really own that this is my pain and this is something that I need to find a way to grieve and to metabolize? So I think, you know, telling our stories is so central to the work of healing. Knowing how to find pleasure and goodness and comfort in non-orgasmic ways are really important for men as well. But I think a lot of times it starts with that core premise of I need to have integrity with my own pain. So a lot of times people try and have integrity with their sexual life, and that's way too far downstream. They need to first have integrity with their own story.
Because they're trying to, in a way, manage the behavior instead of what's underneath or behind it. And that's in most cases, mm-hmm. a losing battle.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is this really fascinating thought from a guy by the name of Lacan, who's a psychoanalyst. And he said that every person has a symptom. And in Lacanian psychoanalysis, he does this word play between, I don't know French, but the French word symptom is symptôme. But then in French, there's also a word called symptôme, which means the holy man or the holy prophet. And so for Lacan, every symptôme is a symptôme, which is saying that the symptoms of our life are the holy prophet that are trying to make something known about our life. And most of the time we try to stop our symptoms. We try and do lust management. We try and get internet monitoring. We try and bounce our eyes, get into accountability. But it's only trying to address the symptom rather than saying, what are these symptoms of our lives really pointing to in order for us to heal? And so that's the work that I do with men and women, but particularly with men, is to be able to go upstream to find out, what's being revealed in your unwanted behavior. So my team did a pretty substantial research project a couple years ago, and we were really interested in finding not just do people watch porn because, you know, we have all those statistics, but far more, why were people doing what they were doing? And so we started asking them questions about their family of origin. We asked about their adverse childhood experiences. We asked about present day difficulties like a lack of purpose or depression, anxiety. And then we put all of that into a research instrument to try and see, you know, what could we find if we put all these pieces together? But Benji, we also asked people to share some of the specifics of the type of porn that they look at. And in putting all that together, one of the things that we were able to do is to predict the type of porn that people would begin to pursue based on the unaddressed portions of their story. And, you know, pretty big research project, but the thesis of it is that, you know, unwanted sexual behavior is not this life sentence to sexual shame or struggle. It can actually become a roadmap to healing to people because embedded within their porn use, their extramarital affairs, and their specific fantasies were clues into the unaddressed and therefore unresolved stories of their life. And so that's what I'm really passionate about, is how do we invite people to see that the very struggles and symptoms of their life are a roadmap to healing and growth.
It reminds me of a quote by Guillermo del Toro, and he talks about it from the perspective of a film director, you know, on set making a movie, and he talks about this idea that your obstacles are showing you your path. And so not to see obstacles as something to shy away from, but as rather to lean into. And I think that's a great way to frame this issue for men, is not to be threatened or scandalized by those appetites or desires or symptoms or things that are coming up in you, but to normalize that and to create space for that, but rather than to act out on them, to look what's underneath them. I think that's a really helpful framework.
Yeah, just, I mean, that it's so important to be curious about why we do the things that we do. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times we might intuitively have some understanding that what I'm doing is wrong, but then we go underground with it instead of really being curious about why is it that this type of porn appeals to me? Or why has it been since I was 15 years old that this was the theme in pornography that really captured me? And so we want to help people to not just, get rid of some harmful behavior. That might be the end goal. But in order to get there, we have to be able to say, how do we develop curiosity for why we do what we do? And any time that we are going to have a lot of curiosity for our behavior as opposed to shame, we're going to be able to outgrow our behavior so much faster. And so when I work with men, I don't ever encourage them to stop porn. I always invite them to consider the question, like, what would be required of you to begin to outgrow pornography? And that really changes it for a lot of men, because they think that they just need to white knuckle something or stop something. But it's far more about that issue of, you know, how do we begin to outgrow this behavior? If you say that it's unwanted in your life, how can we find healthier ways to cope? How can we address some of the unaddressed trauma in your life? And the more that we seek to outgrow those behaviors, I find that men are much more successful in finally beginning to say no to pornography over the long haul.
What are things that you're hearing from men in the course of a journey like that?
In terms of...
So a guy, you know, comes to you and begins to confess his struggle with unwanted sexual behavior that he's participating in. And you begin to invite him into this journey of growth. So what are some of the things that may come up for men in the course of that journey? What are some things that you consistently hear from men that are, let's say, indications of either their wounding or their, you know, milestones of their growth?
Great.
What does that journey look like?
Yeah. So I think of a couple different people. So one client of mine, the middle of the night was always such a difficult time for him. So he had a spouse that, you know, her work required her to leave, kind of being in the middle of the night, being on call. And so when he would wake up kind of all alone in his bed, that was often the context for him to get on porn, call a 1-900 number, or, you know, just kind of cruise around the streets of Seattle trying to look for someone in prostitution. And so part of what we began to kind of do is to go back into his story to understand, like, you know, why did you first get exposed? How did you first get exposed to porn? Why do you think this was initially appealing to you? And one of the stories that he told me is that he, both of his parents worked, and he remembered being in middle school and his parents got him this like Schwinn bicycle. And he said, you know, his parents were gone a lot, but he used to get on his bike. And he said, I used to cruise around my neighborhood just trying to lock eyes with girls in my class and my friends' moms. And for him, that was kind of some of that early middle school behavior of there's a loneliness that he was beginning to experience. And then he gets on his bike and tried to find some level of connection. What he told me is he said, Jay, like, don't get me wrong. I go to sex for the power of it, for the pleasure of it. But far more, when I am in my car, just kind of cruising around the streets of Seattle, I'm trying to lock eyes with women. That's always the most appealing part. And so way more complicated than that. But that was some of our initial work, is to begin to bridge some of this early loneliness and pain in middle school. Eventually grew into a behavior that he didn't know how to soothe himself without trying to outsource that to someone else. And so I find that a lot with men, where most men have what's referred to as a reflected sense of self. And so it's similar to narcissism. But when I was in high school, we used to think of, you know, a narcissist was someone that was full of themselves. They had, at least in my high school, it was the Tommy Hilfiger clothes. It was the Ford Mustang saline. Like, they needed to be able to have these really impressive things that reflected back to them, you know, their worth. And so we used to say that someone was full of themselves. But clinically speaking, narcissism is not being full of oneself. It's actually having an absence of self. And so you don't know who you are. You don't know how to calm yourself. You don't know your value or your worth. And so you begin to look to other things to provide you that sense of validation and calming and soothing. And I find that's really central with the work that I do with men, is that if they do not know how to calm and to soothe and to, in many ways, even validate something of their own worth, that is going to drive them to behaviors that reinforce, you know, does someone find me desirable? Does someone want me? And they will go to very great lengths to kind of affirm something of their desirability. And so that was a lot of the work that I did with that particular man, is what would it mean for you to wake up and to just begin to feel your own body, to feel some of the loneliness and grief and have integrity there. And what he eventually began to do was write poetry in the middle of the night about the loneliness and the disconnection that he was experiencing. And that was really transformational for him, is to be able to not outsource that to the sex industry, but far more begin to say, there is a pain within me that I need to acknowledge.
What do you think is behind the idea of making eye contact? Do you think that was about like the need to be seen, or for like to feel a sense of like connection, or what was the idea there?
Yeah. So Dan Siegel, one of the leading parenting experts in the world, says that children need four things. They need to be seen, safe, soothed, and secure. So seen is that experience of like you had a caregiver that didn't just see your physical needs, but they really saw into your emotional needs. So it's, you know, the image of like a dad who sits on your bed on a Saturday morning and, you know, says, I have the best day planned out for you. Let's go and play. Let's go to the park. Let's go to your favorite restaurant. Let's go get a donut from this particular shop. But it's also the image of a mother or father who, when you come home from a really rough day of school, they see you and they know that there is, you know, your face was not the same when you came home from school as when you left. So when we feel seen, that will eventually leave us with a sense of kind of feeling deeply soothed inside. And the more that we are soothed, the more safe we begin to feel. And so a lot of us, if we, let's say we didn't have parents or a caregiver that really offered us the ability to kind of see into our emotional needs and some of the difficulties that we were facing. Kurt Thompson says that we grow up looking for someone looking for us, and this never stops. And so if we, you know, never had someone that really saw into our pain and also into our delight, we are going to be able to scan the horizon constantly looking for someone looking for us. So I think for that particular client, it was a sense of finding a level of regulation in being seen and being soothed in that time. But that's always the stress of trauma, is that in being seen there, he also created more distress for his own life and also a lot of the women that he was exploiting.
Wow, that's really insightful and really interesting and powerful to think about. Can you mention the four things again? Safety.
Yeah.
They need to feel safe.
Yeah.
They need to feel soothed, secure.
Safe and secure.
Seen.
Yeah. So yeah, seen. So safe is that sense of like, we need to be able to have a caregiver that's strong enough to be able to deal with our big emotions. So we need to be able to bring you know, our anger, our sadness, our anxiety, in order for us to develop a healthy relationship to those things. And soothed is the sense that I know that I can take these really big emotions to a parent in order to know that they are going to be able to help calm me down when I'm feeling these really intense and large emotions. So there's he's an English psychoanalyst who kind of compares what we see Jesus doing on the cross to effective parenting. So he says, like, on the cross, we see that, you know, someone had to give their worst to Jesus. Like, humanity had to give all of its anger, all of its violence, and see that Jesus was able to survive it. And then because Jesus was powerful enough and strong enough to metabolize it, then that actually allows us to know that, you know, our violence, our anger is not going to have the last word. So Winnicott goes back to a good parent is someone that you can bring all of your anxiety, you can bring all of your anger, you can bring your depression, you can bring maybe some of your early middle school porn struggles too. And they are not going to be, they're not going to be overwhelmed by that. They're not going to be shaming of you, but they are like able to be a strong enough and supportive enough base. And when we have a parent that is strong enough to be able to handle those big emotions, that's really what creates this context of soothing within us. And so that's where I would say, you know, as a psychotherapist, we don't have those experiences of really being seen, safe, soothed, and then eventually secure, which then is, you know, that I think is the petri dish that drives us to a lot of unwanted behaviors, is because unwanted behaviors like porn and extramarital affairs, they give us, a surrogate experience of being seen, safe, soothed, and secure. But the inevitable outcome is that it actually reinforces the core reality of our life, is that we're really never going to be able to find good soothing or good security and good just sense of soothing in our life.
Hi guys, this is Benji Nolo from Exodus Cry, and I'm just so excited to announce the release of my new book called Raised on Porn. This is something that I've been working on for the past 10 years and just excited to get it into your hands to help deepen your understanding of porn, its impact on our world, on our lives, and what we can do to heal from it. And so I think you're going to find this to be an extremely insightful and helpful resource, whether you are somebody who is struggling with porn consumption, whether you're a parent and wanting to help have better conversations with your kids and protect your kids, whether you're an educator, whether you're in a relationship and this has in some way affected your relationship, I think this book's going to be a super helpful resource. I wrote it in such a way to be that resource that I wish was there when I started into this. So it's both comprehensive and in-depth. And if you're looking for a one-stop shop, so to speak, I think this is that book that you can get a hold of that's really going to give you the big picture and an in-depth way of how porn is affecting our world and us as individuals and our relationships and our children. And again, what we can do to heal, to find freedom, to better our society. And so I encourage you, get a hold of this book, Raised on Porn, and share it with a friend as well. Thanks so much.
How do you think that religion may complicate this whole larger equation that we're talking about?
So many ways. I think the person that has shaped our Western understanding of sex more than any other was a gentleman by the name of Augustine. And Augustine was a brilliant theologian, brilliant philosopher. But one of the things he wrote in his book, The Confessions, is that the frenzy of lust gripped me and I surrendered myself entirely to lust. And, you know, Augustine was alive in the 4th century. So we're not talking about internet porn. We're talking about, for him, it was orgies and the desire for an affair. And so he developed a very severe theology, I think rooted in his self-hatred of his own sexual fantasies and arousals. And, you know, anytime you have a level of self-hatred about something inside of you, you're not going to develop a very healthy theology or psychology out of that. And I think that is central to a lot of just the way that religion approaches this topic of unwanted sexual behavior, is that there's a lot of language of just don't do it, flee sexual immorality, run from it. But they don't really invite anyone to understand their own sexual mind. So I think of, you know, a passage like Romans 12:2 that says, do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. There is almost no Christian framework to help people to understand their sexual mind. And if you don't understand your sexual mind and why you're drawn to particular themes or fantasies, you're really not going to be able to outgrow it, because you're constantly trying to suppress it. And suppression is a bit like putting a beach ball underwater. It works for a little bit, but the role of the beach ball is to just keep coming to the surface. And that's what I think, you know, a lot of religious frameworks have never really invited people to understand that just their own sexual story, their own sexual desires from a standpoint of curiosity, grace, and understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you have a shame-based operating system, everything's filtered through that in a way that it's almost like you don't even have the ability to frame or process those desires in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this like dichotomy of approaches, one that you just mentioned, the more heavy-handed, severe approach, you know, religious-based approach of suppress, don't do it. And then on the other hand, we live in a culture that is oriented towards, you know, satisfy yourself without restraint. And so I'm curious in your perspective, like the answer to this is not this. Where does sexual health and sexual integrity lie in this whole bigger equation? I don't hear you saying that it's in just suppressing it. I also don't know that I hear you saying that it's in go out and satisfy every appetite that you've ever had. Where in your view do you find the balance or the like a truly integrated, authentic, healthy sexuality that is, you know, governed with integrity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Going back to what you're saying with regard to shame, like, I think that that's so central for us to begin to grapple with is where is a lot of my shame or our shame driving us to these behaviors. So when the neuroscientists talk about shame, they talk about it in terms of like, they make the analogy of three different pedals on like a manual transmission car. So we have this, you know, sympathetic nervous system is the gas pedal, the parasympathetic is the brake pedal, and then the clutch would be, you know, the third pedal on the car. When we are born, we are all sympathetic nervous system, meaning we are all gas pedal. So we want to run through the world. We want to touch everything, taste everything. I mean, kids are all sympathetic nervous system. They don't have a parasympathetic nervous system of, you know, like a braking system to say, no, that's probably not healthy. Don't do that. What the neuroscientists say happens with shame is that when people are exploring the world around them and kind of very curious about sex or porn, and then someone comes in and begins to kind of hit the gas pedal or hit the brake pedal. If you hit that brake pedal without the clutch of kindness, if you've ever driven a manual transmission car, you know that the whole car kind of does not gently die, it jolts forward. And that neurologically is what happens with regard to shame in our lives. So given that we as, you know, men and women, but in this conversation on men, are all sympathetic nervous system creatures when we are children, we need to really help men to understand their sexual arousal and mm-hmm. desire. So when you are 13 years of age, you have something like a shot glass of testosterone in your system. By the time you reach the age of 15, that goes up to, you know, a pint glass of testosterone. So if your whole system is don't do something, well, what is a 14, 15 year old boy supposed to think about when his body is beginning to, in a way, take over? So that sense of the sympathetic nervous system. So do we need to teach people how to break and how to honor? Yes, but we also have to teach them to understand their bodies. We have to teach them to understand arousal. We have to teach them to understand the role of sexual fantasies in their life. So if we don't equip people to understand their sexual story, I think we're consigning a whole generation of people to a lot of struggle in that. So I would say that to the religious component or sector of this mm-hmm. is that You've got to equip people to understand their bodies and give them a framework that's not just about trying to manage their behavior. But then I would say, yeah, there is a whole progressive side that would make shame the primary problem. And so if we can just get rid of shame in people's lives with regard to their choices, then people are just going to naturally get healthy. And that doesn't work either. And so I think of, you know, this philosopher by the name of Levinas, and he says that ethics begins in the face of the other. And I think that's what we have to consider with regard to our own sexual formation. Are my sexual choices good not only for my own heart and my own body, but have I considered the heart and the body and the story of those that I am moving towards? So I think, you know, just simple things like consent, desire. Do you know someone's story? Is what they're participating not just their own free choice, but is there a trauma history that's informing this? And so I would love to see more men kind of grapple with, if I have unaddressed trauma and heartache in my life, how, you know, am I joining in a particular industry that preys off of trauma? And to me, that's where the evil and the heartbreak of the sex industry comes in, is we have this whole demand side that has a lot of heartbreak, a lot of unaddressed trauma, and the desire to find power over that trauma, creating even more trauma and heartbreak for people who also have adverse childhood experiences in their background. So I think if we really grapple with, you know, our own story and our own sense of our own humanity, I think that begins to kind of say, is what I'm doing good and right and beautiful for the other person as well? So I think that's where the integrity piece begins.
So the answer does not necessarily lie in a traditional religious prescription of just, you know, suppress, lie and deny, like, oh, this isn't happening. I'm not, you know, just so, not being completely out of touch with your sexuality, avoiding it, suppressing it, pretending like it doesn't exist, all that, mm-hmm. saying no. Like, I also hear you saying that the answer doesn't lie in being, so it doesn't lie in being shame-based. It also doesn't lie in being shameless.
Yes.
It also doesn't lie in just give expression to every desire because the desire itself is somehow kind of inherent affirmation that this must be good,
yeah.
and, you know, just satisfy every appetite. What I hear you saying is, what I think I hear you saying is it's important for us to explore and understand our sexuality and our desires and our appetites. And so my follow-up question to that is, and then what? So what do you prescribe for men in terms of creating space for your sexuality? So part of what I hear you saying is the idea of having empathy and the idea of operating with mutuality. So like this idea that, okay, I'm going to create space for my sexuality in that I am not only going to think of myself, I'm going to consider my partner. I'm going to consider their background. Before I engage this person, I'm going to be thoughtful about that. Is there more that you can elaborate on in terms of how you prescribe men creating space for their sexuality, especially, you know, like you mentioned, for example, the age of 15,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's going to look different at different stages of life. And like, even in that regard, like, how do you contextualize an individual's sexuality with regards to creating space for it mm-hmm. at different ages? And yep. what does that look like?
Yep. Yeah, so this is where I think research is really important in terms of the work that my team did. So we looked at, you know, common sexual fantasies and porn searches. And so one, the researchers that I worked with kind of labeled it as a sense of power over others. And so this was men who wanted to see someone younger than them, kind of teen categories or college categories, maybe a race that suggested to them some level of subservience, or a petite body type, that those were kind of all linked together. And then we asked, like, what type of story or backstory would motivate someone to seek out that type of porn? And there were three key drivers to that. The first was having a very rigid parent. The second was having an immense lack of purpose in their life. And the third were very high levels of shame. So back to that issue of power. If you had a father who powered over you, who shamed you into compliance, that powerlessness has to go somewhere. And that is the initial lure to porn, is here is a place that I can begin to reverse some of those awful experiences. And now I feel like I have power, which is the very thing I feel like I have not had my entire life. But then the lack of purpose issue, these were men who looked back at their life and saw just a lot of failure. They didn't like their careers. They didn't like where their life was going. And what we found is that men who lacked purpose were 7 times more likely to increase their level of porn. So that was a really key finding, that a lot of times men try to fight to stop using porn, but they never fight to discover a sense of purpose in their life. And so that's where I would say curiosity is the third way. It's not just being shameless, but it's also not being bound by shame, but it's being curious about, why am I drawn to this particular behavior? And we can develop that curiosity, then that provides the roadmap to healing. So for that particular man, yes, he needs to address his own sexual health and desire, but he also needs to develop a sense of, how do I find purpose in my life? Mm-hmm. How do I grieve some of these formative wounds that have impacted my life that actually keep me vulnerable to doing harm to others? So that's kind of the work, is how does the symptom, how does the struggle invite us to understand the roadmap to healing? So that would be one. And then I also think about, I know I'm going into a lot of these, philosophers and wordplay, but yeah, I love this stuff. But the root word of sex is taken from the Latin word sacare, which means to sever or to amputate from the whole. So sex then, according to some theologians and philosophers, is that sex is the awareness that I am disconnected from you, from one another, in the way that I go about reconnecting. And so we might see a widow at a funeral kind of grieving. And the philosophers would say, when that widow is grieving, that is an expression of her sexuality at work, because this partner that she loved, her beloved, has been ripped apart, and now she is disconnected. And so that sense of her tears actually speak to this desire for union. And so I think we need to broaden our understanding of sexuality to say it's not just about genitality, it's not just about orgasms, but it's really a sense of, how do I connect deeply to others in a way that kind of makes me feel less alone in the world. And so if my, loneliness actually causes someone else to feel more alone or more severed in their life, that's not a healthy expression of sexuality. So back to that, is this bringing disconnection into a place of connection? And if my disconnection and pain actually creates pain or more fragmentation or more suffering on someone else, that's not a healthy expression of sexuality, because it's creating more division. So healthy sexuality, including our genitals or not, is always bringing about union, beauty, goodness to myself, but also to another.
I love that. I think that's a great working definition for how to govern your own sexuality in an ethical way. And how would you apply that at different ages? For example, you mentioned, the pint of testosterone in a 15-year-old, as that is coursing through a 15-year-old male's body, and his thought life and his imagination and his sexuality is really being awakened. It's, how do you, what advice do you give, or prescription do you give to a 15-year-old for navigating that? Because it's not like you can say, hey, well, just make sure you have one girlfriend at a time, or you know what I mean? It's like, yes, you don't You don't want to advocate that these teenagers are engaging in, you know, sexual behavior that maybe they're not emotionally ready for. And so how do you work with that demographic of males?
Yep. Yeah. So I think especially in adolescence, there has to be a big emphasis on how do we help people to understand their bodies. And so, you know, when someone first sees porn, that's going to be likely appealing to someone. So if you think about driving, you know, down an interstate and you see a car accident, you're going to have some level of arousal because you've never seen it. And so you're going to have some physiological arousal. So if we are telling these adolescents, don't feel those things, it's bad, it's wrong, it's harmful, that's the beginning of hiding for them. So then it becomes this question of like, not if you see porn, but when you see porn, you might have a lot of different responses to it. You might feel arousal, you might feel disgust. One thing we don't talk about nearly enough is just the way that peer pressure and socialization happens with men. But, you know, sometimes you discover it on your own, but often it's another boy kind of showing you something cool that he has seen. And so there's this inner division between, you know, I want to belong here. I don't want to be shamed or humiliated by this particular boy, so I'm going to go along with it. And so we really need to be able to help, particularly adolescent boys, understand like there is a vast spectrum of what you might experience this when you first see it. And so that's where, you know, some sex therapists would say, we don't want to have one 60-minute conversation with our kids about sex. We want to have 61-minute conversations with our kids about this. So that's where, you know, they were exposed to porn. And what type of porn was it? So I was working with a client whose son saw hentai porn, which was like the second most searched for term in porn a couple years ago. And it's basically Japanese anime porn. And there's this notion of sexy innocence embedded within it. And this mother was horrified that her son had seen it. And again, that sense of seen, safe, soothed, and secure, she first needed to soothe and calm herself before she could have that conversation. Because as parents, it's not just the words that we bring, it's our own energy. So we worked with her to get her in her own body, to calm her body down, and then to be able to say, how can we use this as an opportunity to talk to your son about some of the most important and pressing issues of the day? And so we began to talk about, you know, how is racism embedded within that genre of porn? How are kind of stereotypes in the sense of sexy innocence, and how porn degrades innocence, and how can this become, you know, a place not just of separation and disconnection and shame for your child, but how can this actually be a place of connection to one another, but then also a sense of these major themes? So I think we have so many great opportunities ahead of us to help adolescents think about, why am I drawn to this thing? What are some of the themes embedded within porn? And so when we do that, we really allow a sense of agency. So when I think about my son, I want him to begin thinking about, what do I want my sexual story to become? Because, you know, religious culture, porn culture are all shaping his sexual story. So I want him to develop his own ethic and his own sense of like, this is the trajectory of where I want my sexual life and my sexual story to go, instead of it just being something that I'm enforcing from the outside, saying, don't do this, don't do that. But I want him to really think about, what's the trajectory that I want my life to take?
Is there like a parameters to a sandbox that you prescribe when you're discussing these issues with, because even in that, you know, even in a best case scenario situation where, let's say, you are the boy's father, you know, and they have a much healthier framework and grounding for their understanding of the role of sexuality in our human experience. I think there's still going to be, there's a biological urge that, aside from everything else, is compelling that person in a way that I think demands some kind of answer for, like, you know, obviously you don't want to say just, you know, like we said before, you don't want to say don't do it, just shut everything down. You also don't want to say just go give into it freely. So is there some prescription that you give for what that sandbox might look like? Or is it purely something that you encourage them to create their own sort of subjective path for,
yeah,
given the right tools to make their decisions so they have their own agency? Like, I don't know if you can understand like what I'm getting at. I think there's a rubber meets the road moment,
yep,
where the adolescent says, yeah, but can I do this? You know, okay, so it's not porn. It's not, and like, so where does that balance lie at an age where, you know, I just know a lot of our constituents are parents.
Yes.
My book is oriented, you know, towards consumers of porn, but also heavily towards parents as well. I think this is a struggle for a lot of parents in this, you know, world that we live in today, that is so hypercharged with, mm-hmm, sexual imagery everywhere and messages, and also a lot of conflicting stuff that we've talked about, the, you know, shame-based religious approach versus the shameless. So, yeah.
Yeah, so Carl Jung would say that the greatest threat to the life of your child, to a child, is the unlived life of his or her parent. So a parent has to begin to understand their own sexual story. So if you have past abuse, that is going to impact how you show up and the energy that you show up with your child. If your husband has a struggle with porn or you have a struggle with porn, that's going to influence either an abdication, meaning I'm not going to engage this subject because I don't really feel like I have integrity here, so I'm just not going to engage it at all, which is going to be a petri dish for a lot of struggle. Or there's going to be this, like, you cannot have the same struggle that your father had, or do not have the same struggle that I had, which is going to create an energy of a lot of hiding. So the first thing parents have to do is to regulate their own nervous systems and to understand their own sexual story. So if you can do that, that is the single most effective thing that you can do for your child, is to calm your body down and to understand your story. So most parents try to, you know, get very prescriptive and try and, you know, it for really good reasons, do the best that they can for parenting, but they have never addressed their own sexual story and therefore the energy that they're bringing to the conversation. So first is always address your own story before you try and address the story of your child. But secondly, you know, good parenting comes down to these two words, attunement and containment. So attunement is like, I see into you, as we've been talking about, but it's the ability to, you know, attune to your child's face, to attune to their needs, to attune to what their bodies are going through. But then a good parent also allows for a level of containment. So a child might want to go to bed without brushing his or her teeth, but good parenting is like, no, you actually have to brush your teeth tonight. So that sense of how does a parent begin to offer a level of containment to a child, particularly during adolescence? And so I think just kind of given technology, the influence of that, I mean, if you don't have, one of my friends, a guy by the name of Chris McKenna, who runs an organization called Protect Young Eyes, he says that, you know, the single greatest digital device in your home is your router. And so that sense of it, you got to have a good router and you have to have good parental controls that create a level of containment there. But then you also need to help that adolescent understand that their body is going to be going through a whole lot. So mention 13 to 15. The male brain is not fully developed until the age of 26. And so when we think about why are these teens and adolescents and early people in their early 20s not making good decisions, well, part of the dilemma is they don't have a fully developed brain. So when I think about a lot of my sexual harm that I did to others, but also my own, you know, struggles with pornography, they were in that kind of 15 to 26 year old range. And so I think we need to be helping people to understand, desire, but then also the sense of, you know, this is also the season of life where I don't want you to be fearful of your sexuality, but you also have to know that there's going to be a lot coming out and a lot emerging within you that we need to be able to have integrity with. So these are all places of relationship and connection. These aren't places of hiding. So that's where I think, yeah, we've got to attune to realities of loneliness, heartache, desire, arousal, testosterone, but then also offer a sense of containment that says, you know, this is kind of what's best for you in terms of internet, not having unlimited access to this. There's certain pieces of wisdom that a family really should begin to engage on behalf of the life of that adolescent. But I wish people had told me about what was happening in my body at 15. And I've had so many clients that, you know, they felt like something was evil or wrong with them because they had sexual arousal and they were in a religious community that conflated arousal with some level of sinfulness. And that is destructive teaching. And then, you know, if you don't have any understanding of brain development and, you know, decisions that you're going to make without a really clear sense of, is this not only good for myself, but is this good for someone else? It's just not the way that we are often trained.
Wow. This is so fascinating to get more deeply into these like issues of predominantly, I mean, male sexuality is really the thing I feel like that has been at the forefront of our minds at Exodus Cry with this film, Buying Her, and everything I mentioned at the outset. And it's really insightful to hear your perspective on these things. I, in some ways, feel this is almost a menu of like many conversations mm-hmm. that of rabbit holes that you could go down and explore yes. deeper, because every time I hear you say something, I've got like 10 follow-up questions.
Yes.
Sadly, we're out of time for today, but I'd love to continue this conversation with you, Jay. And I love your compassionate disposition, and it's clear you've done a lot of work in this space. And I'm really grateful that you're out there and really helping other men with this issue. That's so important. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Benji. It's been an honor to be with you, and thank you for the work that you and your team are doing as well. It's stunning, remarkable work.
You can check out all our podcast episodes, articles, and films at exoduscry.com and join the daily conversation by following Exodus Cry on all major social platforms.